Okay, we've just finished looking at the essentials, the fundamental elements of what God is saying in His Word concerning Israel and their land, and what He is doing with them today. But most people don't think Bible when they think about the conflict in the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They just don't go there. They don't know what the Word of God says. Even people in the church don't really think that way. They don't think what's God's perspective. They just look at the facts, what they think are the facts. They just look at what's going on right now. So I thought that we would take a short crack at looking at the history of the conflict. Now, we could easily have spent all day just looking at the history of the conflict in the last 120, 130 years. We're going to try and kind of truncate that down into about 20 minutes or half an hour to just get the basics of where you can go to find some of this information, kind of what's going on. Now, let me just give you a name. If you're interested in looking up more information on this in a really kind of fun, simple, and enjoyable way, just look for a guy named Danny Aiellon, A-Y-A-L-O-N, A-L-O-N, Danny. He's an Israeli ambassador. He has a number of YouTube videos. Each one is about 6 minutes, 5-6 minutes long. There are a series of about 7 or 8 of them, and he does a really good job of giving you the basics of what's happened in the last 100 years from different perspectives, answering different questions. So, and it's entertaining to boot, kind of fun to watch too. So that's just a place to send you if you're looking for a little bit more information that you want to linger and think about some of these issues a little bit more. And then if you want to dig even a little bit deeper, I can put together some kind of a list and we can make sure that that's available to you of just sources that you can go to that you can trust to find out some more information about this. So the history of the conflict. Well, let's begin with just reminding ourselves of something. If God is graciously bringing them back into the land, if that's really what's going on, then what's the conflict all about right now? What's the root of it right now? Who are they in conflict with, and why is it that there's even a conflict now? Shouldn't these things just, if God says, look, the land is yours, who's going to dispute this? Why is there an issue about the land at all? We have to remember that there has been a continual Jewish presence in the land ever since the time God brought them into it. There have been Jewish people living in the land since the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD all the way through. Not many, but there have always been some there. A continual Jewish presence, some have always remained. If we want evidence, just look at the archaeological evidence. The archaeological evidence is overwhelming about a Jewish presence in the land for over the last 3,000 years. That's one of the reasons that the Palestinians are so intent on destroying archaeological evidence. And they are. They are destroying archaeological evidence. In fact, they were digging so deeply and so dangerously under the Temple Mount back about 10 years ago that the walls were starting to cave out, that the inside support was giving way and the walls were starting to bulge. And people began to see, you know, the famous shot of the corner of the Jerusalem. You see the Dome of the Rock and you've got that wall. It was starting to bulge. And people began to say, why is this wall bulging? Because they were getting rid of archaeological evidence. They were digging out the ground so much underneath, there was nothing to support it. And the walls were starting to cave. And that's one of the first clues that the Israelis had as to what they were really up to. Why do they care? Because they want to get rid of any evidence that there was ever a Jewish presence in the land at all. Now, let's just simplify this and just think about the history in that area, in the land of Israel, from the time of Christ. We're just going to give a quick snapshot of the last 18, 1900 years. The basic elements of what's been going on in the land since the time of Christ. What I want us to notice as we look at this is that the land, as we see it there, since the time of Christ, the land was never a nation since the time of the Jews. That it was a neglected territory. That it belonged to various empires, and none of these empires really cared about it. It was just a forgotten place. At the time of Jerusalem's destruction by the Romans, the population was roughly 200,000 people. By the time of the Crusades, Jerusalem's population was about 100,000 people. By the time that the Jews began coming back to the land of Israel in the late 1800s, 8,000 people lived in Jerusalem. Nobody cared about the place. Everything has been different since then. 8,000 people? living in Jerusalem at the end of the 1800s? Not very many people. And you have what? Roughly 750,000 people there now? That's just a flavor for what's been going on in the land. So what's the chronology of the land? First, we had the Romans who conquered the land. Pompey conquered it in 63 BC, and the Romans held on to it until 313 AD. In 313 AD, the land was divided, or the empire was divided, and the Byzantine Empire took over. Remember that the Roman Empire divided into two parts. The Western Empire crumbled, the Eastern Empire survived, the Byzantine Empire out of Constantinople survived, and they ruled the land until 636 AD. What great religion began in the 600s? Islam began. And Islam began this powerhouse religion that came on the scene. And the Arabs ruled the land from 636 till 1099 AD. The population of Europe, the Pope decided that this was unacceptable. We can't have the land of Israel, and particularly Jerusalem, under the rule of the Muslim Arabs. And so they began what? The Crusades. And the Crusades went on for the next 200 years, on and off, as they could afford it, really, as they had the money and the funds to spend. The Crusaders kept control of the land of Israel for roughly the next 200 years. When the Crusaders could no longer fund and hold on to the territory, it fell into the hands of a unique empire called the Mamluks. Mamluk is an Arab word meaning slave. Interesting situation that arose from this condition that these slaves found themselves in. These slaves had quite a bit of freedom. They became wealthy, they became powerful, and they became rulers. They became administrators. And the empire was known as the Mamluk Empire. And they ruled the land of Israel from 1291. They took it from the Crusaders all the way till 1516. In 1516, a final great empire took over, and that is the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, they held on to it until 1917, very end of World War I. So you got a lot of history going on there, but in none of these did really people care about the land. Even the Crusaders, they only cared about Jerusalem, and they only wanted Jerusalem because they didn't want somebody else to have it. But they had no vested interest in wanting it, really. It was just this holy war. So it's been in the hands of others, and yet nobody has really wanted it. Nobody's really desired it. And then we come into the modern history of Israel and their interaction with the Palestinian people. The modern history of Israel. Modern history of Israel began with the rise of a particular movement known as what? Anybody know? Zionism. The rise of Zionism. The modern history of Israel really began with this, which was the beginning of it all. That it entered into the minds of some that there needed to be a change. Now, let me just give you a quick definition of what we mean by Zionism. Zionism is the movement for the establishment and advancement of a Jewish nation in their traditional homeland. You can make it more complicated, but that's in a nutshell. The Zionism is the movement for the establishment and the advancement of a Jewish nation in their traditional homeland. Now, the first Zionist conference was held in 1897, convened by a man by the name of Theodor Herzl. And he held this conference in Basel, Switzerland, for a expressed specific purpose of the desire to establish a Jewish state in their traditional homeland. Those who attended the first Zionist conference in 1897 saw that a Jewish state in their traditional homeland was the only way to defend the Jewish people in what they saw as an increasingly hostile Europe. And it was. There were pogroms going on in Russia. The threat of anti-Semitism was rising in Germany, and we all know where that ended in Nazi Germany. So they saw that coming. They already had a taste of it, and they said, how do we protect ourselves? What do we do? We need to establish a Jewish state. We need to establish it in the land of Israel. And the rise of Zionism was coming up and coupling and gaining strength at the same time as something else was going on that seemed to be completely unrelated. There was a second thing going on in the political world in the land of Israel, and that was something called the British Mandate. Britain took control of the land from 1918 till 1948. At the same time as in Europe, there was this rising sense among the Jewish community, we need a homeland for ourselves. Something was going on within the world at large, and Britain found itself in the middle of it. Now, England was given the rights to rule this territory by the League of Nations. You guys don't know what the League of Nations is, right? It was the precursor to the United Nations. It was the first desired step between the two world wars. After World War I, they set up the League of Nations as a precursor for the UN, and then it crumbled during World War II, and after World War II, it was resurrected with a new name, United Nations. The British got their rights, their mandate to rule this land from the League of Nations. Now, after World War I, both the British and the French succeeded in taking over parts of what was formerly the Ottoman Empire. Remember, the Ottoman Empire was ruling the Middle East. And after World War I, both the British and the French took parts of it and carved it up for themselves. Good question. Yep.
How many nations were part of that first deal?
No idea. I'm thinking it's mainly European and would have been North American, some as well. Started by the United States. There you go. Yeah, they did. You're right. Yes, there's still some debate about whether they should have any part in the UN. So, there were 63 nations. Gotta love the internet. So, after World War I, both Britain and France were given by the League of Nations what was called a mandate, or the legal right to rule certain parts of this former Ottoman Empire. The French mandate included present-day Syria and Lebanon. That's why the French influence in Lebanon is so powerful. The British mandate included what is present-day Israel, Jordan, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. But trouble was already brewing even before and during World War I. There were already other events at play. In this time, in the lead-up, even before they got the mandate, before they got the legal right to rule the land, there were already issues that were at play. You know the story of Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Eliot, or T.E. Lawrence? You know how he was the one who made the famous movie, the guy who helped the Arabs in their fight in World War I against the Ottoman Empire? How does he play into all of this? What the British did was they convinced a local ruler by the name of Shafar Hussein ibn Ali to go against his Ottoman rulers and side with Britain in the war. And that's really where Lawrence of Arabia showed up. He was sent by the British to enable them to switch sides, to train their soldiers, to arm them, to get them ready to fight against the Ottomans. The thing about Shafir Hussein ibn Ali was that he was not Arab. He was a Hashemite. He was not part of the known Arab world. He was a different nationality, different ethnicity. And they made a promise to him that if he would fight with the British, that after the war they would have a Hashemite kingdom, that they would be given territory. Because the British were expecting that they would win the war, they would gain the territory under Ottoman rule, and they were given the promise. However, at the same time as the British are making deals with the Hashemites, with this ruler, they're also making deals working the other side. They're also making deals with other people. And that brings another document into this, known as the Balfour Declaration of 1917. You see, there's another group of people who we know in Europe already are saying, look, we want that territory too. And they're who? The Jews, the Zionist movement, which is rising in Europe. They have eyes on the same territory, and they're looking for it as a homeland. So you've got this movement in Europe which is saying, we want to have Israel as our homeland. That's our traditional territory. And we're moving and working to gain that territory so that we have a safe place to live in the world. At the same time, the British are saying to the Hashemites, if you side with us against the Ottomans, we'll give you the territory. You see, you got a problem? So there's this debate, there's this conflict, but neither side knows what is going on. The Balfour Declaration was named after Lord Balfour, in which he wrote a letter of intent on behalf of the British government. He was the British foreign minister, And he wrote a letter. Yeah, that's the actual letter. You can read it for yourself. You can find it online. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Dear Lord Rothschild. This is his letter, in which he declared the support of the British government for the establishment of a Jewish nation in the land of Palestine, in the land that then was under the Ottoman Empire. But the British had every expectation that they were going to win the land, so they're playing both sides. They're promising the land to two different groups of people, neither one which knows the other is being given this promise of a land. Turns out that there's actually a third promise which is being made between the British and the French about how they'll carve up the land once the war is over. So you got these three different dynamics that are all at play at the same time. Now, in the British mandate, you have this as the territory that was then, after World War I, given to them as their legal right to rule, their portion of the Ottoman Empire. You notice that it includes all of present-day Jordan and all of Israel. Now, what was promised to the Jewish people, to the Zionist movement in Europe, was the totality of that area. They were promised the totality of all of that area today, that that would be given to them. That was the intent of this Balfour Declaration. And then they were going to be able to have it as a homeland. However, it didn't remain that way. Things changed. In 1921, they decided, this is 3 years after they get the mandate, they decide that they're going to divide their territory, the mandate they have, into two parts. They're going to split up the territory that was originally promised to the Jews and to the Jews alone. They're going to divide it into two territories, and they have to do something for the Hashemites who they made a deal with, right? They can't leave them out in the cold. They can't leave them with nothing because they had made a promise. If you're going to help us in the war and we win the war, we will give you territory. So what they do is they divide the land. The Hashemites are expecting all of the mandate, and the Jews in Europe are expecting all of the mandate. So what does the British government do? Divide it into two. They divide it into two. The western half, known as Transjordan, became what is present-day nation of Jordan. They just simply dropped the trans in the front, became the present-day nation of Jordan. It's identical in territory to what they had way back then. The other side, which was left for the Jewish people, represented a staggering 77% loss from what they'd been originally promised. 77% of it was gone. They'd only been left with 23% of what they'd originally been told they would have in the Balfour Declaration. But you can't have both of these parties receiving all of it, or one of them is going to be left out. So they divide the territory and they give that part in the blue, they say they will give it to the Jewish people. What happens is a massive immigration in the 1920s then and the 1930s. Once it became known that the British were going to allow immigration of Jews into what had been promised them, you had a massive outflow of people from Europe getting back out of Europe because they'd experienced the pogroms, they'd gone through World War I, they saw the writing on the wall, let's get out and let's go to this territory. So there's a great increase of Jewish immigration in the 1920s and in the 1930s. Jewish immigration had already begun back in the 1880s, but it wasn't really until after the British began to open the doors and allow them in that they began to come in numbers. Ironically, Arab immigration into the same territory that is now that little bit that was left for Israel began to increase at the same time. Why didn't the Arabs want to go into it before? Because you couldn't live there. No way to grow crops. It was destitute. All the trees had been ripped down. The Jews came back and began to plant trees. They began to plant millions of trees. In the last 100 years, the Jewish people have planted over 300 million trees in the land. It's changed the land. All of a sudden, it's a different land. It's desirable land. They began to irrigate. They began to establish businesses. And because the land was now becoming flourishing and prosperous with the Jewish presence, the Arabs had a desire to be there as well. Now we have a reason to be there. Before that, we didn't. So at the same time as you have Jewish immigration, you have Arab immigration coming into the territory at the same time. Now, the Arabs who were coming in vigorously opposed the presence of the Jews in the land. They said, "We don't want you here," and they began to riot and to fight and to battle one another. The Jews formed groups against the Arabs, and the Arabs formed groups against the Jews, and the British all of a sudden had years of rioting and fighting between these two groups. all inside what is now present-day Israel, all saying, now that we're here, we are the ones who should have it. In 1937, the British declared that the only solution that remained for them was to once again divide the land. So what they came up with was a document called the British White Paper. And again, you can read all of these online. The British White Paper was published in 1939, in which the British said, the only solution is that we divide the land into two parts. We give half of what is now that little bit of blue for Israel. We give half of that to the Arabs. We give half of that to Israel, which means that Israel is down to now less than about 15, 16% of what they originally promised. In the same document of 1939, the British also said, we need to limit Jewish immigration into the land of Palestine. Now, why is that a bad time? 1939? Right on the cusp of World War II. The Jews in Europe were desperate to get out. They were being closed off from England, from Canada, closed its borders to the Jewish immigration. The United States closed its borders to the Jewish immigration. They had nowhere to go. They desperately wanted to get out of Europe, and they were supposed to be able to go to Palestine, to the land of Israel that had been given to them under the British mandate. And the British say, right on the cusp of the most important time they need to move, sorry, we're going to stop immigration. In order to solve the problem, we're just going to stop allowing the Jews to come into the land. It was a terrible timing. And what it resulted in was the Holocaust. The Holocaust was able to take place with greater numbers because there was nowhere that the Jewish people could go. And therefore, they were left in this place where they were going to be killed because a decision had been made about the land. Now, after the war, the British and the Europeans and the Americans are looking at the situation and feeling incredible shame at what they have done because they could have done something different. What it led to was the birth of the state of Israel. You see, everybody after the war was looking at the horrors of the Holocaust, and they were now more of a frame of mind to actually allow something for the Jewish people. So even as world environment was somehow settling a little bit and being a little bit more open, you have the same tension in the land itself between the Arabs and the Jews who were there. After World War II, Britain desperately wanted out of the problem. We just don't want to deal with this anymore. Their empire was getting smaller. Their wealth was gone. They were not the empire they used to be. We can't do this anymore. They wanted to get out. And so they were looking for a way to get out. So what do? They hand the problem over to the new United Nations. They hand the problem over to the UN. And they say to the UN, we're getting out. It's your problem now. The UN came up with Resolution 181 in 1947. Knowing that the British had said, look, we're getting out, the UN was handed the problem. The UN has to come up with some kind of a solution. So they come up with what is called UN Resolution 181. You can look it up online. You can read the terms. You can actually find it on the UN website. What's interesting about this resolution is that it is a recommendation. It is not a legal requirement. There are a lot of people who look at this Resolution 181 and they say, there's the legal requirement concerning the land, but it's not. It's simply a recommendation. Just like the British before the war had recommended a dividing of the land into two parts, the UN picked up on the same idea and they said, we think that maybe also there should be some kind of a dividing of the land. So in this, they came up with this proposal in Resolution 181. The white parts are what was proposed in 1947 by the UN for a Jewish state. And the black parts, right in the middle there, you see Jerusalem. It was to be an international city. And the tan parts was what was supposed to be given to the Arab people. So UN Resolution 181 is simply a recommendation about what the UN thinks should happen to the land. But there's no legal binding requirements to meet that obligation at all. It's simply a recommendation. What this proposal would have done is give Israel only one-eighth of the original land that was promised to them in the Balfour Declaration, in that British mandate. Only one-eighth of the original land would have been given to them. But the Jews heard that and they said, you bet, we'll take it. We'll take it. We'll take whatever you are offering. If you're only giving us this amount of territory, we will sign up, we will agree, we will accept the offer that the UN was making to the Jewish people. The Provisional Government of Israel then accepted the proposal because it recognized the legal right of Israel to have something of their land, to exist as a nation, no matter what the amount of land it gave them. So there's a real advantage for the Jewish people who are living in the land. First of all, this declaration, this UN Resolution 181, at least declared that Israel has a right to exist as a nation, even if it didn't determine what amount of land they should get. They don't care at that point. We'll take anything that we can get. We just want something, and we want the legal recognition from the UN of the right to exist as a nation. The Arab nations that are around it, Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Arabs living in the territory, immediately rejected the proposal outright. They immediately rejected it, and they vowed to stop it by any means at all. They vowed that they would use force if this resolution was ever implemented in any way at all. They, if they couldn't have all of it, didn't want the Jews to have any. They didn't want any of this dividing of territory. In January of 1948, the UN Commission responsible for the territory of Palestine said this in one of their reports. The British government of Palestine, because the Brits were still there until May of 1948, the British government of Palestine fear that strife in Palestine will be greatly intensified when the mandate is terminated, when this deal goes through, and that the international status of the United Nations Commission will mean little or nothing to the Arabs in Palestine. In other words, they won't respect what the UN thinks ought to happen. To whom the killing of Jews now transcends all other considerations. What a statement. Just a couple months, this is in January of 1948. The British were out in May of 1948. Just a couple months before, they say, we've got some concerns here. They are so adamantly opposed to this that the only thing the Arabs have on their mind is to kill all the Jews. If we try and proceed and actually give them territory, give them the legal right to exist as a nation, give them anything at all, they will mount up, and their one intent above any other desire, this is in the British document, is to kill the Jews. Quite a statement, huh? You can understand how there's some reluctance on the part of certain nations to actually get behind this. But nonetheless, the resolution went through. It was adopted. Israel said yes, they would accept the territory that was given to them. The Arab nations and those that were in the territory said, no, we're not going to accept it at all. But now Israel had the legal right to become a nation. They had the legal justification to become a nation. And they declared themselves as a nation on May 14th, 1948. Knowing what the opposition would be, but knowing that they now had the legal right in international law to exist as a nation, and that they had rights to something of the land. But remember, at this point, nothing about whose is what has ever been decided in the land. Never has been. It never has been ever settled by anybody who owns what in the land of Israel. It's all open for legal debate because nothing in this was binding. It was simply a proposal. But the offer of being a real state was on the table, and Israel accepted it. And on May 14th, 1948, the British mandate came to an end, and on May 14th, 1948, the nation of Israel declared themselves to be a people. Now, the moment that that happened, the Arabs responded by saying to the people that were living in the land, the Arab nations around, Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, they all said to the Arabs living in the territory, you need to get out because we're going to go in and utterly destroy them, wipe them off the face of the earth. It'll only take a couple of weeks. I mean, Israel had nothing. They didn't have armament. They didn't have planes. They didn't have tanks. They didn't have anything. And by the way, the British were instructing and arming and training the soldiers on the Arab side when they went to war against Israel's independence. Very interesting. I mean, it's tragic, but that's what happened. So what they say to the Arabs living in the territory, this disputed territory, is, look, get out, and we will go in and clean up, and then you can come back to your houses and everything once we're done. But the problem is they lost the war. 1948 to 1949, longest war that Israel's fought, their war of independence, Israel won the war. Israel won the war, and having told all of the Arabs living in the land to leave the land, they were now numbered around 800,000 people who were forced out of the land, forced into camps, refugee camps, in all of the territories around them. And those people have been in refugee camps ever since. Why? At the same time as those people were forced out, the Jews living in all the other Arab nations were also forced out. Now, if you're a Jew living in Jordan, if you're a Jew living in Lebanon or Syria, and you're being forced out, where do you go? You go to Israel. Almost equal numbers. About 800,000 Arabs left the land of Israel, and about 800,000 Jews who were living in the Arab nations left and went to Israel. Israel absorbed them. Israel brought them in, made them citizens, gave them land, got them into the economy, and they just became a part of the nations. But what happened to all those people that were then told, let's get out of the cities, get out of your territory, out of your property, and then we will just simply clean house and you can come back? They've been living in those squalid camps ever since. Why not? Why were they never, situation never changed? Why are they still there? Because the Arab nations refused to absorb them into their population. They refuse. Why would they refuse to absorb them? Because they need them as pawns. They need them as an excuse. If you absorb them into your population like the nation of Israel did with the Jews, if you absorb them in and they settle down and that's just now their home, then you've lost, in their minds, one of the bargaining chips, the right of return. They've been using the right of return ever since. Now, in this event where they said the nation of Israel has been established, they saw it as the Nakba, the catastrophe. And every year when the Jews are celebrating the birth of Israel, they're celebrating or mourning the birth of Israel. The catastrophe took place. This horrible, unspeakable event of the Jewish people becoming a nation in their homeland. And that's how they think about it and celebrate it every single year. Israel became a nation. Israel became established. The nations around them intended to destroy them were unable to do it because God protected them, and they've been using the people that were displaced as bargaining chips ever since. The Nakba, the catastrophe, had taken place. Now, this begs the question then of who these Palestinians really are. Now, I know that was a really quick snapshot of the basics of the history. Anything I can clarify or try and sort out for you? I don't know all the ins and outs of all of it, but I'll do the best I can if you have a question.
John.
Yeah.
I also heard one time that Jewish people were willing to let a lot of those refugees come into Israel, and they wouldn't go because they were told not to.
Yeah, they were told not to go. There have actually been a number of different times when the Israeli government has offered that they would give citizenship, particularly to people in the West Bank and Gaza. They've said, we will give you citizenship, because there are other Arabs who have citizenship in Israel. Not all the Arabs left. And what did Israel do with the Arabs who remained? They brought them in and made them citizens. We're going to look at a little bit about that in a few minutes. But they just simply said, no, they didn't want that. There's a reason for that, too. Okay, so then who are these Palestinian peoples? Who are they? Where'd they come from? What's their identity? Why is there this struggle? Because you don't hear about it as a struggle between Israel and the Arab nations so much anymore. You hear about it as framed as a struggle between the Israelis and the Palestinians, as if they're a separate, different entity organization. Who are they? Who are these Palestinians? Now, some of the things that we're going to be talking about here may be new to you. They may be something that you go, I don't see how that's possibly true. I would ask you to do this. Just listen, think about it, and at some point, if you've got a question, I'll try and answer it. And some of these things might be things that you kind of have to ponder, and this is where you need to be discerners. Go back, check the sites. I've given all the sites there. You can go back and check everything that I've said to make sure that it's actually there so you can verify all of this for yourself. All right, so where to begin? What we begin with is the rise of the Palestinian people. Where did they come from? Who are they? What's their identity? What's their history? What's their agenda? What do they want? How are they going to go about it? What are the purposes that they have in mind? These are all some of the questions that we need to think about when we think of the Palestinians, because the conflict really is not framed so much anymore as between the Jews and the Arabs. It's between the Israelis and the Palestinians. In fact, somebody, you sent me an email last night from one of the board members, Cynthia did, about rioting in, was it Brampton or Brampton-Bramley, somewhere around Toronto there, where there were the police had to be brought in because of the conflict, because of the rioting that was taking place between demonstrators for the Palestinian side and for the Israeli Jewish side. This is in Toronto, in our own backyard just a couple of days ago. So this is how it's being framed. So who are the Palestinians? Let me just make a statement and then we'll look at it. The Palestinians are a fabricated people. The Palestinians are a fabricated people. Up until 1967, the Palestinians did not even refer to themselves as Palestinians. It wasn't until 1967 when Yasser Arafat said, we need to start calling ourselves Palestinians, that they began to identify themselves as Palestinian. They didn't think of themselves as unique in that regard. Anybody that lived there was Palestinian. In fact, before the Declaration of Independence, the Jerusalem Post was known as the Palestine Post. It didn't matter who you were. If you lived there, you were Palestinian, just like if you're an Ontarian. It didn't matter who you were, where you came from. It wasn't until 1967 that they said, no, that's unique about us. It identifies us as a particular people. Well, let's go back and let's just think for a minute about where the name Palestine even comes from. You don't find it in the Bible. Where's the name Palestine even originate? After the conquest of Israel in 63 AD by the Romans repeatedly had the Jewish people rising up in revolt against them. And they finally put down the last and biggest revolt in 130 AD. And in 130 AD, they changed the name of Jerusalem and they changed the name of the territory. They renamed it Palestine. Palestine is a Latin term meaning Philistine. The land of the Philistines. Why would they name it that? Because they wanted to bring shame. They wanted to bring some kind of a reproach. They wanted to use a name that would humiliate the Jewish people that they had to repeatedly be putting down. So once they put them down, once and for all in 130, they said, we're going to show the nature of our power. We're going to humiliate the Jewish people. We're going to rename their territory the land of the Philistines. Not the land of the Jews, the land of the Philistines, the enemies of Israel. And that's where the name Palestine came from. So then, by definition, anybody living in the territory at the time was a Palestinian. And that's really the way it was used until Yasser Arafat in 1967 said, no, we need to make a change. The Arabs only started popularizing the title Palestinian at the behest of Arafat after their defeat in the Six-Day War of 1967. I mean, why then? Why that year that they changed? Because they needed a new tactic. They had realized that they're not really probably going to win this war against Israel and drive them out militarily. We need a new tactic. So they began to self-identify by a different name. Now that begs the question, why would they fabricate this identity? Why would they say now we are the Palestinians and nobody else has ever lived in the territory or Palestinians, just us, and it is now their self-identification? It's all about the land. It's in order to get the land. If you don't have a people who have a connection to the land, why would you ever be able to argue your right to the land? If the Palestinians are going to argue a right to the land, they have to be people who have a right to the land historically, identificationally. They need to be a real people. So they began to identify themselves by this term, which means that the Palestinians are using the term Palestinian as the basis for their claim to the land of Israel. If they're not a real people with a real identity, why should they get the land? They need to be a real people. They need to have a real identity, or nobody will ever take them seriously about their so-called rights to the land. So you need to create a reason for you to have a right to the land. Their essential claim is that Israel exists on land that therefore belongs to the Palestinian people. If there are no Palestinian people that the Jews have taken the land from, how do they have a right to it? So they make this their objective. PLO Charter, Article number 3, says this: the Palestinian Arab people possess the legal right to their homeland and have the right to determine their destiny after achieving the liberation of their country in accordance with their wishes and entirely of their own accord and will. Now notice what's at the heart of the argument. The argument is that the Palestinian people have a right to the land. Why? Because it is their land. They need to be a people if they're going to make a claim to the land. Therefore, their land needs to belong to somebody. It needs to be belonging to the Palestinian people. It's intentional on their part. So that brings up another question. Have the Palestinians any of the character traits of a distinct people? Have they ever been a real people, like the French have been a real people, or like the Italians have been a real people? Or do they have any of these things that would qualify them as a real distinct people who have had an identity distinctly in the world? And the answer is no, they don't. They don't have even the most basic things that would be required or expected or part of being a distinct people with an identity among the nations. For instance, they have never had their own country. Prior to 1967, you go back and since then they've been claiming this is our country. But before that, there is no history of a Palestinian people ever living in any land anywhere. There is no land that has been theirs. They've never had a country. They've never had some of the other marks about it, such as having a capital city. Jerusalem has never been the capital of Palestine. There never has been a Palestine. There has never been a Palestinian people. The capital, Jerusalem, was never wanted. Nobody wanted it. That's why when the Jews started coming back at the end of the 1800s, there were only 8,000 to 10,000 people living there because nobody cared about it. They never had a capital city. In addition, you look at some of the other things that would be required. What about recognition from other nations? Well, you'd think that the people that would recognize them most quickly would be their neighbors, the other Arab nations around them. No Arab nation has ever recognized the existence of a Palestinian people in a Palestinian land with a Palestinian capital. Just not there. You can't find anywhere ever that the Arab nations have ever recognized it. In fact, the Arab nations have seen the territory as their own. Jordan saw the territory as their own. They annexed the West Bank after the War of Independence in 1948, said it's ours, not the Palestinians, it's ours, the Jordanians. And they only lost it when the Jews took it back in 1967. So even the Arab nations around them don't recognize that the Palestinians are a people with a right to a land and with a right to a capital. And then lastly, there is no history. No history. You think of any other people group, they have a history. They have archaeology. They have literature. They have arts. They have great minds that can be identified as Greek or Italians or the British, or, you know, you name it, the Chinese. They have an identity. They have a history. The Palestinians don't have a history. It's not there. You can't find any great Palestinian thinkers from the 1800s. No great painters. No great works of art. No great literature. No archaeology. It's not there. It's just not there. The Palestinian people don't have any of these things that would recognize themselves as Palestinian. And then you have some very interesting statements. A man by the name of Azmir Bishara, a former Arab member of the Knesset, that's the MK means member of the Knesset, notice that he says something. There is no Palestinian nation. There is an Arab nation, but no Palestinian nation. This was invented by the colonial powers. When are the Palestinians mentioned in history? Never. This is one of their own. A member of the Israeli Knesset, a member of parliament. And what is he admitting about his own so-called Palestinian people? Never existed. Just not there. There's a second statement that was made by the founder of the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, in 1956. He was speaking at the UN General Assembly, and he said this: such a creature as Palestine does not exist at all. This land is nothing but the southern portion of Greater Syria. So even the person who founded the Palestinian Liberation Organization admitted in front of the whole world, never been such a thing. So these are quite the admissions. You know, kind of begs the question, why is it that people believe this? There's a reason for that, which we'll get to, but it just kind of boggles the mind. The same person who founded the PLO, a man by the name of Ahmed Shakara, in 1964, he was fired by the Saudi government as their ambassador to the UN, and he founded the PLO in the same year, an organization that he dedicated to the liberation of a country that he had just a couple years before said never existed. Interesting, right? How do you organize a PLO to liberate a country that you just said a couple years ago in front of the whole world never existed. What are you liberating if you never existed as a country? And that's what he said he was out to do. The PLO's chief military operations officer in the 1970s said this. He was interviewed by the newspaper True, a Dutch publication, 1977. You can read it for yourself. He said this. The Palestinian people does not exist. The creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the state of Israel for our Arab unity. In reality today, there is no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a Palestinian people, since Arab national interests demand that we posit the existence of a distinct Palestinian people to oppose Zionism. For tactical reasons, Jordan, which is a sovereign state and defined borders, cannot raise claims to Haifa and Jaffa, while as a Palestinian, I can undoubtedly demand Haifa and Jaffa and Beersheba and Jerusalem. However, the moment we reclaim our right to all of Palestine, we will not wait even a minute to unite Palestine and Jordan. Yes, the existence of a separate Palestinian identity exists only for tactical reasons. The establishment of a Palestinian state is a new tool to continue the fight against Israel. That just kind of blows you away, doesn't it? But just want to look at a couple highlights for... Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting that it was Joseph Goebbels who was the propaganda minister for the Nazi in Germany that said, you know, that you keep on saying the same lie enough times and sort of believed. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand that the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was a patriot of actually Goebbels. And it's interesting how that is now being used.
Yeah, we're going to get to all of those things in just a minute. Well, you're absolutely right. You tell a lie long enough and people will believe it. I mean, the other thing, too, is that if you don't know what the truth is, you'll believe anything else because you don't know what the truth is, right? So this is what they're saying. Look again at the statement. The Palestinian people does not exist. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a Palestinian people. For what purpose? To oppose Zionism so that we can stand against Israel. Yes, the existence of a separate Palestinian identity exists only for tactical reasons. The establishment of a Palestinian state is a new tool to continue the fight against Israel. It's simply with the purpose of destroying Israel that they have identified as Palestinian and want the territory. By their own admission, remember who this guy is. He's the chief military operations officer for the PLO in the 1970s. He's not just some guy who doesn't know anything. He's right in the very top circle. And he opens a window and he says, look at us. This is what we are after. Then who are those people who call themselves Palestinian? And where do they come from? They are Arabs from the neighboring nations around them. Even in the PLO charter, they always refer to themselves as Palestinian Arabs. We're Arabs. Who are they? Where'd they come from? They're Arabs from the neighboring nations around them. Remember that the population of Jerusalem at the time when the Jews started coming back at the end of the 1800s was only 8,000 to 10,000 people. The entire population of the entire country was under 300,000 people. Where did all these people come from? The Jews were coming from Europe, but where did all these Palestinian Arabs come from? Not from the land that they're in now, not from the West Bank, not from Gaza. They came from other nations outside. The Palestinians are Arabs who've come out of the ancient nations that are around them, a mixed bag mainly from Syria, from Lebanon, from Jordan, and from Egypt. And as the Jews were coming back, they came back, and their names even reflect it. Let me quote something for you from a man by the name of Fatih Hamad. He is the Minister of the Interior and for Security for Hamas. In 2013, so just a year ago, he said this in an interview. Allah be praised, we all have Arab roots, and every Palestinian in Gaza and throughout Palestine can prove his Arab roots, whether from Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, or anywhere. Personally, half my family is Egyptian. We are all like that, meaning the Palestinians. More than 30 families in the Gaza Strip are called Al-Masri, meaning Egyptian. Brothers, half of the Palestinians are Egyptian and the other half are Saudis. This is just a year ago. Again, by his own admission, he's saying, look, we're not natural here. We've all come from somewhere else. This isn't really our natural home. And he makes mention of something about a name. It's reflected over and over again in names. Let me just give you a couple examples. These are some of the most popular names among Palestinians today. Notice they all represent the territory that they've come from. You've got Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Tyre, Sidon, the country of Jordan. All of these reflected in the fact that the name says where you have come from. And then remember that the man who is being interviewed here says that he himself is Egyptian. So by their own admission, by their own names, they're saying, we're not really a distinct and separate people. We've all come from somewhere else. We've come into this territory, but this isn't where we originated from. We're not of this nation. We're of other nations. There are all these nations around us. They're not distinct. They're from elsewhere. So then, what is the history of the Palestinian Arabs who've come from these other nations? Where did the Arabs in these other nations come from? If the Palestinians in the territories of Gaza and the West Bank today are not naturally there but have come from somewhere else, and this is not their natural homeland of descent, but they've come from territories around, then where do the people in those territories come from? This is where the scriptures come back in and give us a clue. First of all, they are the descendants of Ishmael. If there is no distinct Palestinian people that have lived in the land, but they're simply people who've come in the last 100 years from the territories around, then who are these people that lived in the Arab nations around them? Where do they come from? Well, the first thing we find is that they are the descendants of Ishmael. Genesis 25, verse 18. Speaking of Ishmael, remember Ishmael was the one who was born illegitimately before Isaac was conceived. God said that he would make of him a great nation as well, from whom the Arab nations have come. Genesis 25, 18. His descendants settled in the land from Shevelah to Shur, near the eastern border of Egypt, as you go toward Asher. And they, his descendants, they lived in hostility toward all the tribes related to them. Now think about this. You've got the tribes that came from Ishmael, and you've got the tribes who came from Isaac, Jacob. You've got the 12 tribes of Israel, and you've got the tribes, the Arab nation that has come out of Ishmael. And they are constantly in what? Conflict with one another. It's a family dispute. It's a feudal war between the two. So the area that is being described here is all of present-day Saudi Arabia, some of Iraq, and some of Iran. This is the land that the Ishmaelites settled in. The second major group are the descendants of Esau, also known as the Edomites. So we have the descendants of Ishmael who live in hostility towards their brethren, the tribes related to them, who are the Jewish people. And we have the descendants of Esau. Remember that Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Israel. Jacob was the one of promise. Esau was not. Esau was hated by his brother Jacob, also known as Israel. And the two were in conflict with one another even before they were born. Genesis 25, 23, the Lord said to her, now this is about Rebekah, speaking to Rebekah, two nations are in your womb and two peoples will be separated from your body and one shall be stronger than the other and the older shall serve the younger. So there are two nations coming from you. They're going to be at odds. One is going to be the one who is of the promise, that is Jacob, and his twin brother Esau will be in opposition against him. God then, speaking through Ezekiel, said what the nature of that conflict was. Speaking to the descendants of Esau, speaking to the Edomites, he said this, because you have an everlasting enmity, that is a never-failing hatred against your brother and his descendants, the people of Israel, Jacob and his descendants. This conflict has never ended, never passed away, never gone away. Remember the story of Esther, how the Jews were all going to be wiped out. Haman had his great plan that he was going to wipe out the Jews. Haman was an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. Remember how Herod the Great, or King Herod, was going to come and destroy all the babies and killed all the babies in Bethlehem in order to preserve his throne? He was an Edomite technically, but Edomite in ethnicity. He wasn't Jewish. He was brought in against the desire of the Jewish people by the Romans and put in power. He was an Edomite. No desire to love the Jews or to protect the Jews. Happy to kill their babies. He was an Edomite. The Arab world then is comprised of a mixing of these two lines, the Ishmaelites and those of Esau, which means that we can draw a certain conclusion about the nature of the conflict. The Arab-Israeli conflict with Israel and the Jewish people is a family dispute. It's a family conflict that goes all the way back to the time of the patriarchs, where God said about the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Esau, you will be in conflict with the people of God, his chosen people, and that conflict has never ended. They are the ones who settled in all the nations around, who from those nations came into the land that was given to the Jews in the 20th century and have now claimed it for themselves. So the fabrication of the Palestinian people is one of the biggest, most remarkable frauds that has ever been pulled off. And the whole world believes it. It is such a successful lie that there is hardly anybody that you encounter who does not believe that they are the real people who lived there, who had their land stolen. It's propaganda. What's the propaganda for? What's the goal of this all about? If the existence of the Palestinian people is fabricated, you got to ask why. What are they after? What's the goal of the Palestinian people? There's got to be a reason to go to all this trouble to win the world over. So let's think for a couple minutes about the goals of the Palestinian cause. Before we go there, any questions, thoughts, comments before we look at this?
The biggest sin between two nations?
There's a conflict between the two, between the descendants of Jacob, who are the 12 tribes of Israel, and the descendants of Ishmael and Esau, who have intermixed with one another and become the Arab people. That's the nature of the conflict. It's really a family fight, if you want to go back that far. Yeah. Yeah.
Because the whole thing is fabricated, and I know that the land was called Palestine for a while, but what I find totally baffling is how many Bible commentators, even from Old Testament books, call the land Palestine.
Yeah. And it's not that hard to find out the truth. Yeah. You can find it right in the Roman records. It's right in your history books. Yeah, the name is completely made up. There's no warrant.
But it's another way, it goes with the replacement theology thing, you know, diminish the importance of the Jews and what God is doing with them.
Yep.
And it plays right into the everything that's happened.
Yeah, language is so important too, because I've noticed too, anybody familiar with Palestinian Media Watch? PMW, that's another organization you might want to look up, Palestinian Media Watch. It's an Israeli organization. What they do is they monitor everything said in Palestinian media, whether it's radio, whether it's TV, whether it's in print, in newspapers, magazines, doesn't matter what it is. They read it all, and they translate it into about 8 of the major languages of the world and then publish it, put it online. So you can read in your own language, whether French or German or English or Chinese. You can read for yourself what is actually being said by them, because what they say to the Western world is different from what they say to their own people. And in Palestinian Media Watch, it's amazing how often people will say stuff. They'll catch them. They'll say stuff, and nobody ever calls them on it. They'll say statements to newspapers. They'll make comments at the UN. And nobody ever stands and says, hold on a second. You need to back that up. Hold on a second. How is it that you can make this kind of blatant statement and nobody ever calls them on it? Just a recent event, the death of the Arab boy, that immediately has been blamed as a revenge killing by the Jewish people. And it's now being propagated in the Western media as a done deal, like it's automatically assumed and believed that it was naturally the Jews who did it. It may turn out that somebody did do it from the Jewish people, but it's not been decided yet. But they speak of it as if it has. And nobody ever calls them and says, hold on, that's still under investigation. That's just a bit of an idea of what I mean about this use of terminology. Nobody ever calls them and says, hold on a second, is that really what we know for sure? It's just presumed that that's what they're saying is true. So what are the goals of the Palestinian cause? Number one, destroy the nation of Israel. And they make no bones about it. It's not hidden. It's not talked about in hushed words behind closed doors. Oh, this is what we're going to do. They're very open about it. In 1986, a Palestinian leader by the name of Bassem Abu Sharif said this about the goal of the cause. The struggle with the Zionist enemy is not a struggle about Israel's borders, but about Israel's existence. It's not really even about the land. Ultimately, it's about Israel, right? Let's destroy Israel. I mean, they want the land too. We'll get to that. But at the heart of it, got to get rid of what's in the land. It's about a destruction of Israel. Speaking of Palestinian Media Watch, I pulled these two things. These were both within this year off Palestinian TV. Notice this one statement. Destroy the throne of Zion, the house of absolute evil. This is what they get fed on their TV in a regular diet. Destroy the house of Zion, the throne of Zion, the house of absolute evil. I like this one. But I swear that if we had a nuke, we'd have used it this very morning. Speaking of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. This is this year. They're putting this on TV. So they're not trying to hide what their goal is. Their intention is for the destruction of the nation of Israel. Now, God had said that there was going to be a time when this desire would come to head. It hasn't yet fully developed, but it's on its way. Let me just give you a flavor of this. Psalm 83, verses 1 to 8. O God, do not remain quiet, do not be silent, and O God, do not be still. For behold, your enemies make an uproar, and those who hate you have exalted themselves. They make shrewd plans against your people and conspire together against your treasured ones. They have said, come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they have conspired together with one mind, that is, they have one objective altogether. Against you they have made a covenant. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, notice who's first on the list. Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined with them. They have become a help to the children of Lot, Selah. Now, what's the objective of all of this? We're talking about the nations that all directly revolve around the nation of Israel. All of the nations directly related and on the borders of Israel. What's the objective that they have here? Their objective is pretty intentional. What they want to do is wipe out Israel as a nation. And that same purpose is in the Palestinian mind today. I mean, this is exactly what we see developing. A like-mindedness amongst the people that they have one desire to destroy Israel, to wipe it out, and to get rid of it. The intention remains the same. The intention is to destroy Israel. Let me give you a couple other references that just show you again where they're coming from. This was a statement that was made on Palestinian TV in the year 2000. All the agreements are temporary. Now, remember that in 1993, they made signed the Oslo Accords, which are going to bring peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat, remember on the White House lawn? Year 2000, he says, all the agreements are temporary. We, the nation of Palestine, our fate from Allah is to be the vanguard in the war against the Jews until the resurrection of the dead, as the Prophet Muhammad said. The resurrection of the dead will not come until you do battle with the Jews and kill them. We, the Palestinians, are the vanguard in this issue, in this battle, whether we want to or whether we refuse. All the agreements being made are temporary. In other words, all we're doing is buying time until we can do what we really want to do according to the word of Allah, which is to kill all the Jews. Let me give you another one. This was from, again, Palestinian TV, the year 2001. We will blow them up in Hadira. We will blow them up in Tel Aviv and in Netanya. By the way, this is before the Intifada began in 2001. We will fight against them and rule over them until the Jews will hide behind the trees and stones, and the tree and the stone will say, and then he quotes, Muslim, servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, kill him. We will enter Jerusalem as conquerors, and Jaffa as conquerors, and Haifa as conquerors, and Ashkelon as conquerors. To do what? To kill all the Jews according to the word of Allah. Even the stones and the trees will say, look, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him. That's what their intent is. And then, let me just give you one more. O Allah, destroy the Jews and their supporters and the Americans and their supporters. O Allah, count them one by one and kill them all without leaving a single one. Statement made by one of the members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. These are their rulers who are saying this. These aren't just some people in a back room somewhere who don't represent. These are the nation's leaders who are saying this. the intent is to destroy. Now, why? Yeah. I don't, but I can get it for you. I've got the URL here. You can look it up. Yeah, by the way, if you're looking for a URL and you don't have it, you know what a URL is? It's the website address you find. Everything should be there. If it's not, just ask me. I have it. So what are they up to? Why want to destroy the nation of Israel? Because they want the land that belongs to Israel. It's ultimately going to be about the land. They want what God gave them, that they were not given. And so their intention is to seize the land. Remember again, right in the middle of that passage we read in Psalm 83, they state what their goal is. Who said, "Let us possess for ourselves the pastures of God." Yes, it was given to the Jewish people. Yes, it was given to the descendants of Israel. But we want it for ourselves. They have one objective, and that is to get what they were not given. They want the land, the pastures of God. God prophesied about this very goal in connection with the Arab people. Let me show you a couple other examples. One is from Ezekiel chapter 35, verse 10. God is speaking to the Edomites, remember the descendants of Esau. He says to them, "Because you have said, 'These two nations and these two lands will be mine, and we will possess them,' although the Lord was there." What is the goal of the nation of the Edomites, those of Esau? What do they want? We want the land. We want to take what's ours and what is theirs, mix them together so that we can possess them both as if they are our own. And God says, hold on a second, that's where I am. You can't have the land. Ezekiel 36, verse 5. "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, surely in the fire of my jealousy I have spoken against the rest of the nations and against all Edom," there they are again, "who appropriated my land for themselves as a possession with wholehearted joy and with scorn of soul to drive it out for a prey." In other words, God is angry with them. He speaks against them. Why? Because what do they want? And by the way, notice it's not just Edom, it's the rest of the nations. They want the land, and they want to drive out the inhabitants, and they are joyfully and wholeheartedly saying, we want to take and appropriate for ourselves land that was not given to us, land that was given to God. And then again, notice God's statement in Joel chapter 3, verse 2. "I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations." Where do you get scattered from, Israel? From the land. "And they have divided up my land." What's the intent of the nations? To drive the Israelites out, to drive the Jews out of the land, scatter them. We don't care where you go. We want the land. We're going to take it for ourselves. And God says, hold on. Those are my people. And it's my land. So is this the goal of the Palestinian people still today? Let's let them speak for themselves. I think the most powerful thing is just let them speak for themselves. Yasser Arafat. In 1996, he said this, "We plan to eliminate the state of Israel and establish a purely Palestinian state. We will make life unbearable for Jews by psychological warfare and population explosion. We Palestinians will take over everything, including all of Jerusalem." Now notice the date on that. 1996, he's in South Africa, and he is recorded on radio. He's in a radio interview in South Africa, and he's recorded as saying this. He thinks he's long ways from home. Nobody's going to see it and hear him and remember. But this is what he says. This is just 3 years after he stood on the White House lawn saying, "Our desire is to make peace with the nation of Israel. We want to be at peace. We want to live side by side in harmony." No, you don't. What your intention is to buy time. What your goal is, and he states it openly, 3 years after having said, "I want peace," what he says is that I want to destroy the nation of Israel. And he says, we will take over everything, including all of Jerusalem. Now, there are other things that back this up. Look at the Palestinian charter statements. If you want to know the cause of a people, look at the documents that define them. So you look at these statements that are found in the Palestinians' charters, and there are a couple different organizations, two primary ones that we'll spend time on today. There are others as well. You can read their documents online as well, but for the sake of time, we'll look at the two big ones. You've got Hamas, which rules in Gaza, and you've got Fatah, which is the PLO, ruling in the West Bank. What do both of these have as their opinion in their documents, in their founding reasons for existence? What do they say? Well, let's first look at the charter of Hamas. You're probably well familiar with Hamas about their fact that they're constantly launching rockets, and then when the Israelis fire back, they say, oh, we're being fired upon, having fired first. If they never fired, they would never be fired upon. Just that simple, you know? Look at what they say in their statements. Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it, just as it obliterated others before it. This is in the founding charter of the organization of Hamas. They also go on to say that the Islamic resistance movement believes that the land of Palestine is an Islamic waft, that is, territory to rule, consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. It or any part of it should not be squandered. It or any part of it should not be given up. In other words, it goes against our very religion before Allah to give this up. We have a responsibility to hold on to it and to gain it back for our future Muslim generations. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. Initiatives, proposals, and international conferences are all a waste of time and vain endeavor. In other words, in order to reach our goal, there's only one way. Our goal is to destroy Israel, to have the land for our descendants. There's only one way to do it, not through agreements, not through peace accords, but through war. It's the only way to do it. Yeah.
Is jihad a country?
No, jihad is a holy war. You hear the term jihad, it's an Arabic term just simply meaning go to holy war. Yeah. So this is what they are saying. Now, Hamas is usually painted in the news as the more radicals, right? They're the ones who are the really ones out there on the left wing, and they want to destroy everybody. But at least with Fatah, with the PLO, you know, in the West Bank, you've got a little bit more moderate. You've got people that have maybe a little bit more desire to be part of, you know, Western thinking, you know, give the Jews a chance. So let's think for a minute. Let's look for a minute at what the charter of the PLO, Fatah, is. Fatah is just simply the political wing of the PLO. What do they say in their documents about what their intentions are, the reason for their existence? What is it that they have in mind? The PLO was founded in 1964, and they came out with a particular document. They changed the document in 1968, which we're going to look at in a couple minutes. But the covenants of this document set forth the goals and aims of the organization. And almost all of the articles in the covenant of their founding explicitly or implicitly deny Israel's right to exist and reject any peace process with the Jewish nation and desire to destroy it and take the land for themselves. Let me just give you a couple examples. Article 9 of the present PLO charter. Armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine. Thus, it is the overall strategy, not merely a tactical phase. The Palestinian Arab people assert their absolute determination and firm resolution to continue their armed struggle and to work for an armed popular revolution for the liberation of their country and their return to it. Remember, they've already defined their country as all of the nation where Israel is today. All of it, they have said, is theirs. Article 7 in the PLO Charter says, he, speaking of a Palestinian man, he must be prepared for the armed struggle and ready to sacrifice his wealth and his life in order to win back his homeland and bring about its liberation. Notice it's all about the land. Article 19 of the Palestinian document. The liberation of Palestine from an Arab viewpoint is a national duty, and it attempts to repel the Zionist and imperialist aggression against the Arab homeland. Now, by saying Zionist and imperialist aggression, he's talking about Israel. The Israel are the Zionists, and they're the imperialists taking away the land that belongs to the Palestinians. And aims at the elimination of Zionism, that is Israel, in Palestine, in our land. And then Article 21. Article 21, the Arab-Palestinian people expressing themselves by the armed Palestinian revolution reject all solutions which are substitutes for the total liberation of Palestine and reject all proposals aiming at the liquidation of the Palestinian problem or its internationalization. Notice what they say there in the final thing. Our objective is the total liberation of Palestine, and nothing that stands in the way is a solution. No peace agreement, no accord. Now, they are saying and believing this even while they're signing documents about the fact that they want peace with Israel. simply not true. Just simply look at what they say in their documents. By the way, one of the big things that they said in 1993 when they made peace with Israel, when they entered into the Oslo Accords, is that they promised that they would rewrite their constitution and change the terms of this constitution and not call for the destruction of Israel anymore, and they never have. In 1996, they were called on the carpet, and they were told, look, why have you not revised it? And they said, okay, we'll send it to committee. It's been in committee ever since. And seriously, it really has. It's been in committee for pondering and further thinking about how we would rewrite it, and it's never come out of committee. It's never been changed. It's still there. There's another way that you can know that their intention. Just simply look at the maps. This is off the PLO website. You can go to the PLO website, and you say, look, what do they intend? This is what they put in school books, textbooks, and things. Yeah. There's no Israel, by the way, there.
I just bought a world map.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Depending on where you are in the world, Google Maps will not show Israel, depending on where you are in the world. British Airways doesn't show Israel on their maps for flights that are going through the Middle East, even if you don't land there, if you're just flying over it, and you want to know where you are in the world, you know how they put a map up? Israel's not there. It's Palestine. Mercedes-Benz has changed all their maps. I mean, it's pretty big now. Yeah. Because Britain has a big clientele that fly beyond the Middle East or to the Middle East, and they don't want to offend, just like Mercedes-Benz doesn't want to offend. They got a lot of people in Abu Dhabi buying Mercedes, and so you just cater to your clientele. You just take them off the map. Yeah. And then lastly, Palestinian apartheid. We'll talk about the fact that the Israelis are being accused of apartheid, but really it's the Palestinians who are intentional on having an apartheid state. Apartheid meaning that there is no room for anybody else but us. No Jews allowed in a future Palestinian state. That's true apartheid. Now, how do we know that this is what they're after? Just last year in Cairo, Mahmoud Abbas was interviewed, and this is what he said. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas laid out his vision for a future Palestinian state in which he insisted no Israelis will be allowed to remain, quote, in a final solution, we will not see the presence of a single Israeli, civilian or soldier, on our lands. No, right now, you have Druze living in Israel, you have Arabs living in Israel with full rights, you have members of parliament, you have members of the military that are Arabs in Israel. They have full rights and parts functioning in society as everybody else, along with the Jews. But a future Palestinian state, no room for any Jews whatsoever of any kind at all. That's an open statement. Nobody calls them on this. Nobody says, hold on, you're blaming the Israelis of being an apartheid state, and there's no evidence of it at all. And you're the ones who are openly saying this is exactly what we intend to do. And nobody has a problem with that? Yeah, Jim?
It's hard to know whether to call it apartheid or genocide.
Well, yeah, it's true. So if this is their goal, what are the methods that they are going to use in order to bring about this goal? How do the Palestinians plan to accomplish their goal of taking over all of the territory and gaining it for themselves at the expense of all the Jews who are living there? Remember, not one of them is allowed to stay in the land. Not one, if they get their land. Well, one of the simplest things that you do is you simply repeat over and over, we have the right to claim all the land that Israel controls, no matter where it is or when. If Israel's in control of it, it's ours. Simply claim all the land that Israel possesses as yours. I mean, even UN Resolution 181 never envisioned that. They envisioned that, okay, the Jews would have some and the Arabs would have some, but the Jews clearly get land. What do the Palestinians say? No. All the land that's under Israeli control, we want it. Palestinian territorial claims have adapted, though, according to the circumstances in history. Interesting. You know, the territory that Israel has controlled is not the same in 1948 as it is today. It ebbs and flows. It comes and goes. And the Palestinian territorial claims have ebbed and flowed along with it, which makes you realize it's not just about the land. It's about whatever Israel has is the land. Now, where do we get this? Prior to 1967, you have this sense of what is claimed by the Palestinians. In 1964, they were organized as an organization. The PLO came into existence, and they came up with their first charter. The wording of the first charter in 1964 is not the wording of the charter now. Prior to 1967, the PLO made no claims to the territory of the West Bank or Gaza. They explicitly said, we do not want it. It's not ours. It belongs to somebody else. Notice what it says in Article 24 of the original PLO document of 1964. This organization, the PLO, does not exercise any regional sovereignty over the West Bank in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, or the Gaza Strip, or the Himam area. Its activities will be on the national popular level in the liberation organization, political and financial fields. Now notice what they say. To put their Arab nations around them at ease, because if you read it and you hear that the Palestinians intend to take over territory that Jordan thinks is theirs, or take over territory that Egypt thinks is theirs, because Egypt controlled the Gaza Strip, and Jordan controlled the West Bank, and it was part of their sovereign territory. They claimed it. They annexed it, said it's ours. If you, the PLO, start up and you say, look, what we want is Gaza, and we want West Bank as well, the Egyptians will not support you, and the Jordanians will not support you, because you want their territory, right? So what do you say? You say in your charter, no need for that. It's already under Arab control. All we want is the territory that the Jews have. So Egypt, don't worry, we don't want Gaza. Jordan, don't worry, we don't want the West Bank. It's not ours. What an admission. We only want the territory that belongs to Israel, where the Jews are. This is what they say in 1964. But then, everything changed in 1967. In 1967, all the circumstances changed, and from 1967 on, the PLO has rewritten their documents and re-identified what their objective is, and now it includes Gaza and the West Bank. Before the 1967, they didn't want it. It was somebody else's Arab territory. But after 1967, they say, now we include in our rightful territory of possession all of Gaza and all of the West Bank. Why the change of tune? What was it that brought about a change in the intent and their goal concerning land? Why the change? What happened? Six-Day War. Six-Day War happened. June 6th, 1967. Six-Day War broke out. It only lasted 6 days. And in that war, Israel won the territory of Gaza from Egypt and won the territory of the West Bank from Jordan. And it came under Israeli authority. And ever since it came under Jewish control, the Palestinians have now said, now we want it. Before that, no need. But now that it's under Jewish control, that's land that we want as well. By the way, Jordan did not have legal rights to the West Bank. Some people are saying, give the West Bank back to Jordan. But Jordan didn't have legal rights to it. Under international law, Jordan doesn't have legal rights to the West Bank. They took it without it ever having been established as to who owned it. They simply annexed it. So you can't give it back to Jordan. And that is why it is best to call it, if you want anything, disputed territory, but definitely not occupied, because it's never been settled legally as to what territory is what. So they have this issue changed, even in their documents, a different desire after the war. A second thing that you do is you deny any historical Jewish presence in the land. They were never there. The Jews were never there. Now, when you rewrite history, that's called revisionist history. You revise it to suit your needs. So I don't like the real history of what's really the truth of the history of the land, so let's just revise it. Let's just change the history. Let's make up a history. And what their intent is, to deny any historical Jewish presence in the land. Again, back to the PLO charter. Oh, sorry. Let's read this guy first. There is a view. This guy is a lecturer in an Arab university. It says, there is a view that where it, that is the Dome of the Rock, stands, was the Holy of Holies of the fictitious temple. And by the way, that is merely an illusion. There is no remnant of it. It's a myth, a story of no value like the Arabian Nights and other legends. Only in Palestine, 60 years of digging, and they found nothing at all, not a water jug, not a coin, not an earthen vessel, no bronze weapons, no piece of metal, nothing, absolutely nothing of this myth, because it's a myth and a lie. This digging has not left a single meter unturned, but it has achieved absolutely nothing. Palestinian TV, 2009. I mean, this is what you're getting as a constant diet, that there is nothing there. And yet, you go to Jerusalem. A couple years ago, I was very fortunate, blessed to be there in 2011. The year after I was there, they dug up David's palace in the city of David. So they're right now excavating King David's palace, but he never existed. It's not there. They're digging up coins. I mean, just constantly stuff, you know, from the era of the Bible times. It's everywhere in Israel. And their intention is to say over and over and over, no Jewish presence in the land ever. It's just not there. Nothing at all. Okay, I think we're going to take a break now for lunch. How do you people feel about that? Okay, if you would allow me, I'll say grace kind of collectively for us all and thank the Lord for his provision, and we'll take a break. Father, thank you so much that you are a God who is sovereign. If you weren't sovereign, if you weren't in control, how desperately we would feel. Thank you that you are always absolutely going to keep every commitment that you've made, and therefore we are able to trust you. You prove yourself over and over in each of our lives. Thank you for good food and the fact that we can eat it in peace in this country in which we dwell. Bless our time and our fellowship, we ask in the name of Christ. Amen.